Thank you for the nice introduction. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. So as the title says, I will talk about house tax resources and their applications. You see here the outline of my talk in the first slide. After a short introduction, I will talk a little bit about synchrotrons, really just the basics. And I will not mention specific applications here. I will just show you the fields where synchrotron can be used and also some of the methods, just in general. Then I will go to X-ray field electron lasers. Then again, I will give a few slides about the basics. And then I will talk about the most important thing, that here we need a new thinking to use the really exceptional possibilities given by the beam. This is very unique and very strong beam. So we need a different approach to the problems. And I will talk about this and all the applications, which I will mention, that there will be a few specific applications, will be connected to this, how we should use this very good facilities in the future and how we should use this efficiently. If I will have time at the end, I will talk only very shortly about laser-driven sources. Basically, not about the sources themselves, but with the connected things which is coming from these laser-driven sources, the future of accelerators. And this is the so-called wake field accelerator. So I will mention this because that can change our field of research in this hard X-ray area also. So let's start with the introduction. We are using X-rays for structural studies and for other studies almost, not almost, more than 100 years. So in the beginning, it was very important for us to solve a structure at all. And that was really the problem, how to solve a structure. We first saw structures of very simple inorganic materials. Then, as the time went on and the technique developed, we could solve now larger and larger and more complicated structures. When the beginning of 60s or something like that, we could solve now not inorganic but complicated organic structures containing in a unit cell, let's say 10,000 atoms or so. However, in this time range, we worked on static structures, and that's an important point here, that using an X-ray tube, we could measure static structures. Now this picture changed when the synchrotrons came in. Since synchrotrons give you power structures, and this allows, at least in principle, to measure the dynamics of changes during the process, how the structure changes and how the properties of the materials are changing. So that was one thing which was very important when the synchrotron appears and also appeared. And also we had a large change in brightness, what you see on the left side panel. And this large change is really spectacular. It was 10 orders of magnitude at the synchrotrons compared to the X-ray tube, and again, about 10 orders of magnitude when we went to X-ray field electron lasers. And I will go later into details how we can use this X-ray field electron lasers efficiently. However, we have to mention that all of these important developments in X-ray field could not happen if we didn't have better computers and better equipment around the synchrotrons and around the X-ray field electron lasers. Because the amount of data which we have is usually increased. So to work with it online or offline, it's really very critical to have very good computers. The same thing is if you want to run a synchrotron, operate it, for the operation you need very good computers, because that's also changed. The same with the free electron laser. So that's why I put here on this slide the development which happened in the computer business. Okay, so that much about the introduction, and let's have some reminders here how point charge radiates. That's just a reminder everybody should know, but it's good to have a picturesque feeling about it. So if you move your charged particle, then it gives you a electromagnetic radiation. The electric field is changing, which is in the left side. You see very picturesque way, in a very simple geometrical way, how you can calculate the field if you move your particle with delta V velocity. So you have an acceleration and the velocity of the particle. Now, if you translate this to a circular orbit, then you can have the electric field of a charged particle going around in a circular orbit from the same equations as you had derived from the left-hand side figure, and you end up with this central figure. And that is in the case when the particle is moving at not very high velocity. So in the non-relativistic case, you have this so-called dipole radiation. However, if the particle is moving with very high velocity, close to the light velocity of light, then you have a relativistic contraction, a relativistic dilation, and that causes that the beam is not dipole-like, like in the central figure, but it is very much forward directed in the direction of the velocity, and in this case it's tangential. So that's what we use at synchrotrons, how the synchrotron works. This gives the basics to that. The next slide, you see what we should do if we want to produce a particle in a circular orbit. So what we have to do is we have to use a magnetic field perpendicular to the plane of the ring. However, this is very very bad to do it in a large area like a synchrotron, which is shown on the right side. So in this case, what we do is we use a local fields around the ring, and these local fields are arranged in a in the path of the particles as they go around, and that we call the lattice of the ring, these units which are around the path of the particles. So that is which determines the ring parameters, and we have a very important parameter brightness, which I showed at the beginning. And the brightness is determined by the current emittance and spouse banks, which is the three parameter which determines this. And the current and the spouse banks is something trivial. The emittance is nothing else than the size connected to the size of the radiator, so the punch which is going around, and also the divergence of the beam which is coming from the electrons. Okay, now let's see what are those units which are around the ring. So the typical ring looks like this. It's a very simplified picture, and here we have the local dipole magnets, which are called the bending magnets, and these produce this magnetic field which turn the electrons on their way, and they are going around almost in a circular path. However, in between the dipoles, we have straight sections, and in the straight sections we can have various units. One of the most important unit is the radio frequency cavity. This is necessary because as the electrons are going around, they radiate. By radiating, they lose energy. If they lose energy, then they get slowing down, and then they hit the wall of the vacuum chamber. So at the end, we won't have anything if we don't add back the energy to the electrons. So these radio frequency cavity are just giving back the energy what they lose as they are going around. they are working in synchronization with the beam, with the electrons. So that's why the name is coming, synchrotron. Okay, the other important part here is the so-called insertion device magnets. These are periodic magnetic structures. And in the next slide, you will see what how they work and what I mean on this. So here we see the bending magnets on the lower left panel. That's easy to understand, no problem. Then if we put more dipoles, one after the other, but with opposite signs, so opposite north pole, north-south pole directions, and use this to produce, to move the beam, then we will see that we have a bending back and forth, so at the end the beam will not move very much from the central direction. However, in every turn they radiate, and if this radiation is not in no phase relation from one, there is no definite phase relation as we go from one dipole to the other dipole, then the intensity after the disguise of radiators, the so-called picklers, are just the intensity of a single unit multiplied by the number of dipoles in the picklers. So this is going like proportional with n, where n is the number of dipoles. And the energy spectra, or the wavelength dependence of the radiation which is coming out from this unit, are shown on the upper left panel. So for a bending magnet, it's a very nice smooth curve. There is a cutoff as we go for high in energies or longer or shorter wavelengths. And for the wiggler, we have not just higher intensity, but usually we can use a larger magnetic field than in a single dipole magnet, so we can make the radiators radiate at higher energies or shorter wavelengths. So that's why the wiggler is shifted to the left and to the higher energies or shorter wavelengths. Now, what happens if we put again a very similar arrangement as in a wiggler? However, we put this dipoles closer to each other and in a different geometric arrangement with the as the size and the ratio between the wavelengths and the dipoles are, then we can reach a arrangement in which the radiation which is coming from one dipole and going to the other are such that there is a phase relation and a good phase relation, which means that the radiated photons have the same phase, about the same phase in one dipole and in the other, then at the end this radiation now doesn't scale with n, because now we have to add the amplitudes, because we have a phase relation, definite phase relation between the various dipoles. So we have intensity which doesn't scale as n, but scale as n square, because we have to add the amplitude, and the intensity is square of the amplitude, absolute square of the amplitude. So this, however, doesn't work for all wavelengths, since the phase relation is not cannot be kept for all wavelengths. We have a definite this distance between the magnets, so that gives us the definite wavelengths for the radiation, which is the phase relation holds, which means that for some wavelengths we have this high intensity radiation, for some other wavelengths we have less, and that is reflected in the energy or wavelengths dependence of the ondulated radiation. So that's what we use, these three units which we use in a synchrotron. Okay, now I think that much is enough to know about synchrotrons as in general, and we arrived to the usage of synchrotrons, so this is very wide. I just tried to put here the most important methods in the first slide, and there are many, probably I left out a lot. What this shows, that really very high, very large range of methods are available at synchrotrons, and almost all these methods can do time, temperature, magnetic field, and pressure dependence. So we can really have a high variety of possibilities to do different kind of measurement and to study different characteristics of the materials, which we would like to learn more about. Okay. On the next slide, I saw typical application areas of ESRF. I think at other synchrotrons, the ratios of the different fields are changing, but basically we have these possibilities, and one could see that it's really going through all different kind of sciences, and it's a very, very different things can be done, and it is done at synchrotrons. I would like to call the attention probably to one thing, that the largest amount of measurements is going to hard condensed matter and structural biology combined with life sciences and soft condensed matter. So these two fields brings most of the measurements. However, if we look at how the ratio between these two develops, then what we will see that as the years are going, the biology, soft condensed matter, life sciences, the ratio of that is increasing. So that's more and more interested the biologist, and this soft condensed matter is more and more are using the facilities. Okay, now I go to the experts. Why do we need at all better sources if we have so many various possibilities as synchrotrons? So that's, I think it's trivial. Scientist wants to know and wants to understand physical and chemical and biological processes on a finer and finer scales, both spatially and temporally. So what does it mean? That we need shorter pauses, smaller probing, and higher intensity. A better monochromatized beam is also useful. So how can we reach those? We can reach those by hard X-ray field electron lasers. I show here four hard X-ray lasers. These are probably the four largest one. And one can see that these are based on long accelerators. So the rings which are shown here are just part of a large facility which is not part of the X-ray itself. Usually a synchrotron is by the X-FAS, many places. So they are based on accelerators, large accelerators, kilometer long or even longer, that's the range. So these are really large infrastructures. Now, how they work? So we know that for X-rays, we don't have a good reflectors. So if we want to make a laser and we would like to put back the X-rays into the medium which amplifies it, then it would be difficult because we don't have good mirrors. So what we have to do is we have to use this in a single pass, and we use the so-called self-amplified spontaneous emission. What does it mean in this case? We see an undulator, which we know already. So as the electrons are going through in an undulator, it produces radiation, but it's trivial that as it go along and the radiation is stronger and stronger, we have more and more photons as we go along with an undulator. So what happens when the radiation field reaches a point where it acts back on the electron bunch, which we put into the beam, put into the undulator? So what happens is that the bunch starts to produce micro bunches, so the field order it in a way that it will be better phased with the field. As it is better phased with the field, we will have more and more precise radiation. So more the energy is better, much going is much narrower and narrower, and it is phased much better and better, these micro bunches with the radiation which is coming out, which is the positive feedback. So it will further sharpen these micro bunches. okay, that cannot go forever because that is a radiation loss. So at some point, it will stop this increase, this exponential gain. But when we reach there, what we have is a spectrum which looks like that. So here we see that as compared to the undulatory radiation, we have very, very narrow peaks where this free electron laser radiation comes out for different type of undulators. And we have a baseline, which is a short pass spontaneous radiation. This is a very broadband radiation. So this is a very bright radiation, monochromatic and very well collimated. So like a laser should be. How can we use this radiation? Before I go to this, I will mention one more thing because I think that's trivial for everybody, but it's better if I explain a little bit that the different bunches, since this is a spontaneous project, the different micro bunches radiate different way because they are spontaneously increasing. And that means that we have many spikes in the beam, which is shown on the lowest left panel. Okay, if we want to have a nice star shape, we have to somehow order and have to somehow synchronize, that would be the better word, synchronize these oscillators. So what we can do is that first we produce a closely monochromatic beam, but not very monochromatic. Then we monochromatize this, that is a very strong beam already. And we put this monochromatized beam in a second undulator. So from here, the electrons which arrive in the second undulator will not start from zero field, but it will start with the field which the monochromators already have them. So they synchronize the passes, and then we can get a much nicer shape, which is shown down here on the right lower panel. Okay, so that much about the free electron lasers. I just would like to mention one special laser, the European XFEL. The reason for mentioning this is twofold. One is that Hungary is part of the XFEL, so we have a little bit closer connection to this. The other reason is that this is special among the others, and I will show in the next slide why they are special. They are special because they use a so-called superconducting technology, LINAC, which results in the fact that they can produce high repetition rate. Usually the free electron lasers have 100 Hz, that's around that. However, this one could have more than 20 kilohertz, which means that even if we switch these passes to various measuring stations and distribute them, even if we distribute five, six places, then we will have in one measuring station, we will have more pass per station than we could have with a non-superconducting LINAC. So we have a really multi-user facility which can run, so different measurements can run at the same time. Okay, here is how this facility looks like presently. They have three undulators and they can work at the same time. And on the three undulators, they have six measuring stations, two for soft X-rays and four for hard X-rays. Okay. Now, since these X-rays are really giving us very, very bright beam, and a lot of energy can be deposited in a sample in a very short time, we need a different thinking of how we use this. So everybody learned about radiation damage. What I show here is what happens if we put a small particle in the beam, but that happens if we put a large particle, just it's a little bit different way, but the radiation damage will be very similar. So what happens here is that the electrons at the beginning leave the system, and the particle get charged, positively charged, and these positive charges repel each other, so we have a Coulomb explosion. And this explosion, if we look at the scale, then the time scale, which is down here. Now let's see how to start it again. I go back here and start it again, sorry. So even at the very first time, in the first few nanoseconds, first few femtoseconds, the particle is really changing its shape. So if you would like to learn how the particle looks like, then we should do the experiment very fast. And that's part of the new thinking which I mentioned. So the idea how to circumvent this problem came in 2000 from Janos Haidu and co-workers. They suggested so-called single molecule imaging. What does it mean? It means that we put a single molecule into the beam, not a crystal, because they know, they work in biology, and they knew that the bottleneck in crystallography is that we have to produce a crystal. Not many times we can produce crystals from biological systems, so it would be very nice to measure single units. So they suggested to put into the beam single viruses, for example, and measure the structure of that. But what happens, I just showed you, that in a very short time, these explode. So we have to do the measurement very fast, and the calculation showed that this should be in the range of 5 to 10 femtoseconds, or even short. So that's pretty difficult. At the beginning, the sources produced 100 femtosecond pulses, and that would be not enough to have a good resolution if we would like to measure this. We start just because of the Coulomb explosion. There are other problems. Okay, now today the sources can produce even 1 femtosecond or shorter pulses, although the intensity of these pulses went down much more compared to the 100 femtosecond pulses. However, these measurements wouldn't work without any additional knowledge and any additional tricks, I would say. The first trick is that we cannot hold the sample into the beam, so we have to spray in. That's a new technique. So the spraying in comes with this kind of technique. However, if you spray in the sample, then we don't know the orientation. We know from single crystal diffractometry that if we want to get a 3D picture, then we have to take many, many reflections in the 3D reciprocal space and determine the back reflections in 3D and not only just one or two reflections. So if we take one shot, we won't know the three-dimensional structure. Here, at the single molecule, we have to have the same three-dimensional information, so three-dimensional intensity in the reciprocal space. To get this, we have to illuminate the sample from different directions. However, our sample is destroyed in one shot. So what we do is we drop in millions of samples with the same structure. Now that's also a problem to produce exactly the same samples. But let's suppose we can do it. Even if we can do it, we have a problem that we don't know their orientation. And that's again a new thinking that we, in principle, can determine the orientation from the measured diffraction pattern. Okay, if we put all this together, the spraying in, the fast measurements, and the workout of the orientation, then in principle, we will be able to measure the structure. So in the next slide, I show the first of this kind of experiment. And here we can see that in principle and in practice, we could do this experiment here on the upper panel. You see that we took many two-dimensional pictures in many orientation. Then we could use the special codes to put together the three-dimensional intensity distribution and determine the structure. Now, the only problem which you see here is this sentence, that's a three-dimensional reconstruction with about 50 nanometer resolution. And this 50 nanometer is very bad compared to what we expected as atomic resolution. This is 5 angstrom or so. So we are very far from what we expected at 2000, that we will have an atomic resolution structure. This was the first demonstration experiments. One can tell that with time it will develop, really develop. So today we can go down to 10 nanometer or so, but at the moment we cannot go further, and 10 nanometer is even very far from atomic resolution. So we need a lot of work to use this method in a way as we expected at the beginning. However, as usual, the driving force is not now the single particle imaging, but other things which came up from the thinking, that type of thinking what we had at single particle imaging. So this thinking is the measure before destroy came up in one of the ideas of Harry Chapman, who thought that, okay, if we cannot do these measurements on single viruses, why we can't try and do measurements on very small crystals, which we can produce, but we cannot measure at synchrotrons and any other sources, because these crystals are below 1 micron in size, so we cannot measure. There's a radiation damage and everything is makes them impossible to measure at a synchrotron. So try the same trick as we try with the single particle, a single virus. Do the same spraying in, do the same evaluation method, so orient the measured patterns after the measurements and find the orientation. But now we have not a continuous diffraction pattern, but Bragg peaks. And at the end, we have Bragg peaks in three dimensions, very similar way as we have in a normal diffraction measurements. And we can use the methods which we used earlier, the traditional methods to work out the structure from Bragg peaks in a single distance diffractometry measurements. In the bottom part, I show you a very well-known material, the photosystem one, with which one can do with synchrotron radiation on a large crystal, but one can also do X-FEL, and one can compare the results and see that the X-FEL work is as good as the synchrotron radiation works. So the principle works, and this is called serial crystallography. And this is now the workhorse at X-FELs, and we can combine this with a pump laser, and we can do a time resolve studies, a pump probe experiment the same day, but a much shorter time ranges than we could do at the synchrotron, because here we have femtosecond passes, and the synchrotron we have nanosecond, picosecond, 100 picosecond passes. So I show you here now real application, not just demonstration. This is a time result serial femtosecond crystallography experiment of the photoactive yellow protein. And there is the left side, you see how, what kind of processes are and what kind of time scales are what we are looking at. And on the right side, you have a series of structures which were solved by serial crystallography from the picosecond range to the microsecond range. And this really shows that this method can be used efficiently for learning about systems which we couldn't measure before. Okay, the next, which I would like to show, the next example is again a new idea, the so-called mix and inject serial crystallography. And this is something like when we want to learn how an antibiotic acts on the on, for example, in this case on the tuberculosis, so an enzyme beta lactamase which is the part of the Mycobacterium tuberculosis. So one cannot measure this by traditional methods, because one would like to see how the process is going on when antibiotics meet with the bacterium and starts to act on it, what it does, how it happens. So it's very difficult to do, because when you add it, then when you put into the synchrotron, already everything is going, everything is done. So what we have to do here is that we mix on the fly the two type of particles or the two type of material, and on the fly happens this process, the binding and the cleavage. And that's what it is shown here. And Here, the time resolution is not determined by the pulse length of a free electron laser, but is determined by the flying time of the particle in this range band from the point where they meet and the from that where you measure. So here you see the 30 millisecond to 2 second case, what happens and how this process, which is on the left side shown, is going on in reality. Okay, now that was when we used many particles in the evaluation process, but sometimes, and the measuring process, but sometimes we cannot measure many times the same things because we cannot repeat the measurements. So in this case, we would like to have information from a single pulse, and that's really difficult. However, we could, in this case, we could, for example, measure structures at extreme pressures, which we cannot produce for a long time and cannot produce exactly 100 gigapascal. So it's difficult to repeat the measurement. So in this case, we would like to learn from one single pulse. How can we do it? So that is here a theoretical problem, and there are technical problems. In the next few slides, I will show two approaches. And that's almost the future, I would say, because presently there are not many measurements of this type. Now, this is a so-called two-particle diffraction, the first which I would like to show. I was part of this measurement, so I know more about this. The previous application, I was not part of that, I just mentioned. So, in this case, we again spray in the bioparticle, which we would like to determine the structure, into the beam. However, we add a cluster. We call it reference cluster, which could be, for example, in this case, in our case, a small xenon cluster. So one would ask that why we will have, why we are better off if we add one more particle, the picture which we will measure, the diffraction pattern will be even more complicated. So what we gain? So what we gain is, comes from holography. So usually holography, not usually, holography is done in a way that we have an unknown particle and known reference beam. The known reference beam are scattered by the particle, and it can also reach the detector, and these two interferes. And from this interference pattern, even if it is a single picture, we can get back the three-dimensional structure of the particle. Why can we do this in holography? So this is shown on the right side here, that the if we want to calculate the intensity distribution on the detector, then we have to add these two waves. In our case, we know the reference beam because that's what I mentioned, but we don't know the object, the scattering beam. However, if the reference amplitude is much larger than the object amplitude, then we can neglect the square of the object amplitude. And then we end up with one unknown, which is linear, that's important, which is linear in the object, and we know the reference. So that's why we can reconstruct the structure. Now, if we go back to our problem, we see that that's why we add the reference. However, that is a problem, because in our case, the reference beam is not larger than the object beam, but smaller. So it is not holography, just akin to holography. And further, the reference amplitude is not known because we don't know the distance and the relation between the reference particle and the object particle. So the evaluation is going in a different way than it goes in holography. But we try to use the same thing, that we try to get the reference beam defined. So how can you do this? We can do a model calculation. And then we see that if we have two objects oriented in different ways, then we have a different pattern. So just looking at the pattern, we can tell how the two particles are situated. The exact vector which is between has to be determined from the picture, with an approximation that both particles are a sphere. Then it could be determined this distance. And if we know this, then we can go back and solve the structure. So in our case, it turned out that we have two particles at the same time in the reference beam, as reference particles, and we could analyze this, and we find that the two particles is shown here, and we could find vectors, where the reference particle is, and we could get information only on the projection of the density. Because if we go back here, you see that we have only 4 degrees of measurement. It's a very small angle, and in this angle, the aval sphere is almost flat. So we don't have a curvature. So if we could measure, let's say, 30 degrees, then we could have a good resolution in the other direction, which is perpendicular to the beam. Okay, let's go back here. So we could get a projection only. I will not go into detail because I don't have too much time and I have a lot of more to say. So the second approach is going with the formation of coastal lines. Now, in this case, we hit the sample with a beam from the source. The sample, the particles in the sample are scattered. They then fluoresce. And the fluorescent radiation, which is now is not connected with the incident beam, are spherical. The spherical waves can go out from the sample and can be scattered by the sample. These two waves interfere, like in a hologram. The difference here is that the since we have a long periodicity here, this very, very simple single scattering approach, which we use here, is not true, doesn't work, because everything is in phase if we have a good crystal. Then we have to use a multiple scattering theory, a dynamical theory, to describe the shape of these curves, because they will have a shape, because the scattering is coming out, the strong scattering is coming out in the Bragg directions, which is can be easily find out from here. So if we go to the next slide, we show that how the shape of the diffracted curve changes as we cross the line here. So it shows that as we change the phase of the structure factor, I hope that it works once more, yes. As we change the phase, which is shown here, the shape of the reflectivity curve changes drastically. So from this, we can determine the phase and we can determine the structure, because that's very similar to the holography in the sense that we get the phase. Here, I show the experiment which we have done, and here I show some of the curves, some of the structural lines, and we all together measure quite a lot. Here I show, and here are the phases which we determined, and here are the phases which could have, which is the ideal one. And one could see that it's pretty good what we had. And this shows that we can determine from the coastal line pattern the phases. And what happens if the crystal is not good? So if our crystal is dead, then we can go back to the single scattering theory, and we can neglect the circle, and we end up with holography. And this is the so-called inside source holography, which we did the first experiment of this kind in 96. And we again went to a synchrotron radiation source and tried to do it today in a different way, because at that time it took us 2 months to measure a hologram. And now we went to ESRF and we could measure this same, not the same hologram, because that's a different material than the first one which we measured on. But we measured on nickel oxide and we could do these measurements in 1 second. Now, what does it mean to do it in 1 second? At the synchrotron source, in 1 second, we have 10 to the 12 photons about, which is exactly the same as what we have at an X-ray free electron laser in 1 pulse. So 1 pulse contains 10 to the 12 photons. So this means that using good detectors, using good sources and good computers, we can collect a full hologram or a full coastal pattern within 1 single pulse of an X-ray. And that was what I wanted to show you at the beginning. I thought that single pass imaging would be very nice. Okay. So we haven't done this experiment yet, but we are applying for time and we hope that we will do this experiment. Okay, I think I'm close to the 45 minutes, but I finish now in 2-3 minutes. So last thing is femtosecond laser driven X-ray sources. So I will not talk about these sources. I will just mention that we have different processes, different type of sources, and the coherent sources mostly work in the soft X-ray regime, and the incoherent sources we can get hard X-ray radiation. However, if we compare this hard X-ray radiation to the radiation which we get from a free electron laser, it's very weak. So we should use this in a different way, and I am not going to this. However, this type of femtosecond laser driven X-ray sources went to another thing, which is not the source itself, but the so-called wake field acceleration, which is coming from this type of research. And that can really change our world in accelerators. What does it mean? So, if we put a very strong, let's say 30 joule pulse beam, which is coming in 100 femtosecond or so, into a gas, then it makes a wake field. It separates the positive and negative charges, and as it separates this, then in between the positive and negative charges, we will have a very high electric field. And if electrons are trapped in this range, then they can be accelerated because this field is much larger than the field which is at the normal LIMAC. It is 1,000 times larger, the gigavolt per meter, what we can have. So in this way, we could produce very short accelerators, which is in the range of meter and not kilometer. So we can imagine that if we have a tabletop accelerators, that was really transform our work, which we could do with synchrotrons and with free electron lasers, because in this case we won't need a few kilometers line accelerator. I put here in the bottom Csaba Tóth, who is one of the pioneers in this work, and he is coming from our institute. Mm-hmm. He now works at LBNL. But he did some experiments on this field and very well known on this part. And also on the left side, I put how one could make free electron laser using this small accelerator. The undulator is the same, but the accelerator is very short, could be very short. We can do this, I just mentioned that we can do this not only by a laser field, but we can do very similar things with particle beam, and this is the particle beam driven wake field acceleration. I am not going into detail of this because I don't have time, but that would be some future direction which we should be aware of. Now, last slide. This is the X-ray infrared structure, and also I mentioned in the Laser Lab Europe, because that's, I think, the largest laser organization, certified organization from 18 countries in Europe. And the newest one is the ELI, the Extreme Light Infrastructure. This has three legs in three places. I am not going into detail of this, but I would like to point and might like to mention that I hope that besides doing very nice science in these laboratories, I hope that they will work on the wake field acceleration, because that would be really a transformative thing for all of the scientists who are working on X-rays. So I hope that they will put emphasis on this one. Okay, and now I arrive to the end. I will not go through this summary. Everybody can read it for himself or herself. I just would like to thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Can you mute your microphones, please. Unfortunately, at the beginning, Gyula was already talking when, yeah, so please mute your audio. Thank you. So thanks very much for this interesting presentation. And at the end, we learned about the large facility you mentioned during the at the beginning of your presentation, Mego desktop, so laboratory accelerators. Okay, so the presentation is now open to discussion, comments, questions, please. Can you hear me?
Yes.
There is some technical problem, so on my on my view, yeah, everything is stuck. Okay, so any questions, comments, please? A very easy question. What is the situation now with the ESRF membership of Hungary? Can you tell me something about that, Gyula?
Okay. So it was earlier, we were part of CentralSync, and that was three countries together as part of ESRF. Now that's stopped, because one at time one country and the other country dropped off. Presently we are part because we have a 5-year contract with them.
Part means members, paying members.
Paying members, but not real, not full members. Mm-hmm. So we are paying our part as alone, and we were allowed to do this even if we are below 1%, because 1% would be the minimum. Yeah. But we are below 1%. But we are allowed because the ESRF thinks that the other countries will come back. I mean, the CentralSync countries will come back. And then we can continue together with the other three countries and be 1% together. So I know at least that this is the situation. I don't know how long it will be.
CentralSync was formed by which countries?
By Czech and Slovak. Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Okay. So Austria is no, not individual
Austria
member.
Is separate.
But member.
That's, I don't know exactly that, a full member or part member. That's, uh-huh. I don't know. Uh-huh.
Okay. Yeah. So the other two mentioned facilities, ELI and XFEL, in these we are regular members. Okay. So Shani.
Yeah. Yeah, the question refers to the signal to noise ratio. So it seems that for this single pulse measurements, you practically have always 100% visibility, or how high is it, or how can one, because you certainly have a preconception, and I'm interested in the reconstruction of these nice pictures from the measuring data.
Okay.
Everything is loaded with noise. Yeah.
And single molecule imaging.
Yes.
Okay. So in single molecule imaging, the signal-to-noise ratio is dependent on the size of the particle.
Okay.
Because if the size is very small, then the signal is very small.
Now that's good.
We cannot go down infinitely with the particle, which means that we cannot measure, let's say, on 100 atoms. As you know, from 100 atoms, we cannot have more photons scattered than, let's say, 100.
this is a linear process, yeah.
So because there is no more electrons, take the electrons off, then there is no electrons to scatter. So we can have as many photons maximum as the number of electrons in the sample.
Yeah.
Okay. So that means that we need at least, let's say, 10,000 atoms in the sample. I would say that's the smallest which I expect to be able to measure.
Yeah.
Now, if you have this much of atoms, then probably you will have the number of photons about tenths of this in the best case. Because you have the Auger process and inelastic process, so you don't have all the photons elastically scattered.
Yeah.
Which means about 1,000 photons in a picture.
Yeah.
You have, let's say, 1 million pixels, okay, in the detector. Then in one shot, in 1 million pixel, you have 1,000 photons. Every 1,000 of pixel have one photons.
Yeah,
so it's pretty bad.
So it follows the law of rare events.
As a law of rare events. Now, the situation is not as bad as I told you, because now everything is centered in a very small angular range. So in the center part, you have much more. But in the other part of the detector, large angles, you have much less.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you want to have good resolution, you need the high angle part. From the small angle part, you will have a worse resolution, just the shape of the sample.
Yes.
So it's tricky. It is very difficult to tell you that what is the signal-to-noise ratio, because if you look at the central part, very good signal you have. Almost all the photons is going there. But if you look at the high angle part, no photon is there. So you have a compromise between the noise level and also the particle size and the resolution that you would have. If you don't want good resolution, then it's okay. You just will have this 50 nanometer or something like that. Even this is a very large sample, which I showed you. This is about 500 nanometer, the sample. This is a big sample. Now, so this is a very difficult measurement. Usually, if you use a large enough sample, then I would say there is no problem in the signal to noise. But as you go down with the sample size and you go to the point where what I told, 10,000 atoms, that's very bad. So probably with today's experimental setup, we cannot solve the 10,000 atoms. I would say 100,000 atom or higher, now it's okay, we can try to solve. Now you told that you are interested in the evaluation process itself. Okay, then the first step is to find the orientation of the 2D pictures which you take, because you have a random orientation. And that's a very tricky thing. There are many different kind of methods. One could use is the similarity of the pictures which are close in angle. You can imagine that the scattering pattern is continuous. If you are very close in angle with two orientations, if you drop enough samples, there will be close orientations. Then those pictures will be very similar. And there will be one line in every picture which just coincide. They cross, these pictures cross each other. They look in the reciprocal phase as umbrellas. And these umbrellas cross each other on lines, on circular lines. The circular means that where the two umbrella crosses each other, so a cross section. And this can be used, this common line can be used to make the orientation. But I cannot go into detail because it's quite tricky. And about 100 people or so was working on it for 10 years. So that is not really a problem which you can solve in a day. But this is the basics, that the similarity of the pictures and this line. You have, if you use this, and you could do a good statistical evaluation on the lot of pictures, then at the end you can fix that problem. And if you have already have the three-dimensional intensity, then even then, to solve the structure of a non-periodic system is not trivial, because you don't have the lattice, which is a very good measure, a very good thing, because you know the size of the unit cell. Here you don't know. Here what you have is the size of the high intensity region, which gives you back the particle size, basically, because it's a Fourier transform range. One is large, the other is small. So here you use a different method which works on the intensity than one uses in a single crystallography. So one have to use some different methods, but it is doable. So this part is worked out better to solve the structure from the already oriented part, and then to get the orientation. That's the most difficult one. Okay.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you.
May I have a question? You don't watch right hand. Vasily.
I didn't hear anything.
I try to talk. Do you hear me?
Okay, now I hear you.
Yeah.
We can hear you.
I'm Tamás Belgyar, first one on the list. So may I have a question? How do you make sure that, how do you know that where in the beam you have the interaction? And how does it influence?
Okay, that's an easy question, good question and easy. So usually what you do is on the fly, so this is on the fly, when the beam hits the sample, you will have some intensity. If it doesn't hit, you don't have intensity. So you just integrate. And even from the integration, you even can tell that how many particles you have in the beam. Because theoretically, if you know in advance that what particles you want to put in to the beam, then you know in advance and can calculate, at least estimate, I would say, how much you expect a scattered intensity. And then when you see the scattering pattern, then you just add up, so a total integrated number you got, and if the integrated number is such that it's close to the one what you expect, then you have a particle. If twice that, then you have two particles. If it is almost zero, then you have nothing. So that is a very good way to know.
So then how big the beam is.
They change, if you don't have enough particle into the beam, or you have too many, then you change the density of the particle in the spray. Mm-hmm. So that's, again, they have to work a lot on the spraying techniques. There are at least 3-4 types of spraying techniques, different. Mm-hmm. And everybody thinks that his is the best, but it depends on the problem that you have, that what kind of spraying system you should use.
And what is the size of the beam?
The size of the beam can change because you can focus it. The smallest size today, what they tell, is 100 nanometer, so it's very small. They can focus it down to 100, but usually I would say it's a micron. Mm-hmm. So 10 times that. So that's the normal. It's a micron, 2 micron, or something like that.
Yeah, the problem seems to be pretty similar to the cryo TEM problem. So when you have a lot of conformation at the same time in the picture and try to match it.
Yeah, that's right. In this sense, the orientation is the same, just it is in the reciprocal space here, and in the cryo AM, it's in the real space.
A real space, yeah.
And that's why the center of the picture is not fixed in the cryo IR optomicroscope, and here the center of the picture is fixed because you know the zero. And in that case, there is a translation problem also. Here, just an orientation problem. There is a translation plus orientation.
I see.
Mm-hmm. But otherwise, it's the same. And very similar algorithms are used.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome.